Investors Chronicle.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of the Companies and Markets Show. It's Thursday, the 21st of March, as we record. Spring is here at last, and we have our traditional mix of company chat and analysis for you today. We are going to begin with Dowlais, the company that spun out of Melrose just under a year ago, and ask how the auto parts maker is faring amid the EV transition, such as it is. Then we move on to Vodafone, a business whose fortunes have been unequivocally terrible over the past decade, probably even longer. We'll discuss the dividend cut announced last week, the prospects for a turnaround, and more besides. And finally, our cover story in this week's edition of the Investors Chronicle is all about UK software companies and their increasingly divergent fortunes. We'll pick out some of the stragglers and some of the leading lights. On hand today to discuss these issues are Mark Robinson, Julian Hoffman, and Arthur Sants. Mark, I'll come to you first because you're going to be talking a little bit about Dowlais. They've got figures out today. How did they strike you to kick things off?
Not too bad at all, really. There was revenue growth throughout the year, but that was partly as a result of inflation recovery there as well. But the automotive section, the larger segment of the group, that performed pretty well. The company did record an overall loss of £450 million, but that was due to a goodwill impairment linked to the powder metallurgy unit as well, which has struggled ever since the split from Melrose, really. But I guess a cruder measure and one that I often look at is just that gross profit was heading in the right direction. And the operating margin as well expanded slightly, or 30 basis points on constant currency. So it was fairly encouraging on the face of it. I think I covered the company shortly after it was spun out of Melrose there. And the market was fairly doubtful. And that's expressed in the share price performance since that date as well. They've lost about a quarter of their market valuation. But I think these results today will, I think it will reassure investors to a certain extent.
Well, they are, I think, down another 5% today as we speak. So some more reassurance might be needed, mightn't it? What seems to be concerning investors today is the intimation of some weakness in the months ahead in terms of the outlook for the automotive market in general. Is that fair to say?
Yes, but I think that needs to be set in context against what happened through 2023 as well, because a lot of the aspects that were holding the market back prior to them, you know, most famously the semiconductor supply constraints, they eased over that period, and the inventory situation picked up as well. And there was actually some decent export growth from China. Looking ahead, they say that overall volumes for light commercial vehicles is likely to trail away a bit, but I think it needs to be seen in context of, you know, this last year results for the industry as a whole, which were probably better than a lot of people thought, you know. And it also comes down to, it might be a problem over the next year as well, they're saying, because of further product launches as well and the timing linked to them. So I'm not sure it's necessarily a pessimistic outlook is warranted.
There was some positives in there, some other positives in terms of cash flow generation looks fairly decent. They announced a small buyback and that margin expansion you mentioned as well. So I think even in the automotive segment is about 80% of the business, we should say. And even though they cited some of these headwinds, they do think revenue will be more or less the same as the year just gone, which implies, I think it's fair to say that organic growth is going to be decent in whatever the context that they see happening over the next year. But the other thing I wanted to talk about is the wider context for the business being the EV transition.
Yeah.
Have you got thoughts on, it's very easy to, or very difficult to sum it up in a good or bad type answer, but do you think the EV transition is going to be a headwind or a tailwind for the company? Because there are really conflicting analyst thoughts on this matter.
Yes, and I'm going to join that cadre as yeah. well. So as I pointed out on various articles in the magazine over the last couple of years, really, I think all you can say that we're looking at a period of quite significant disruption, and that applies not only to the manufacturers, but also to dealerships up and down the country, and also to companies that are engaged in the supply chain as well. So, I mean, it's a bit of a moving target at the moment. You know, the Biden administration has just beefed up regulations that should help the transition to electric vehicles. But by the same token, on an organic basis, you know, there's been real pushback, particularly in the United States. There's a lot of people seem unwilling to cope with various inconveniences linked to electric motoring as well. You can understand it in the States as well, because at this stage seem better suited to built up urban environments. So in answer to your question, I can see positives and negatives there, which is an unsatisfactory answer, I know, but I think we're going to see major disruption. It wouldn't surprise me down the line if a major automotive manufacturer goes to the wall. You know, it's not inconceivable, and if it's widespread enough. I mean, the U.S. automotive sector has been bailed out at least twice during my lifetime. So whether the government's in a position or is willing to come to its aid is open to question as well. I mean, part of the problem as well, which will lead to further disruption, is that we're going to see a possible influx of much cheaper Chinese EVs. I mean, this is something that the government over here are looking at as well. But none of this, you know, and so you've seen, you know, companies like Tesla, for instance, having to effectively cut back their margins to try and remain competitive. So yeah, I mean, this is going to feed into that general disruption. I'm not terribly confident that it's going to be as smooth a transition as politicians would have us believe.
There are really two strands to this as well, aren't there? Because there's that uncertainty you've just described over the transition and how quick it will take place and how quickly it will happen. And the last year has suggested it might be a bit slower than previously thought. Equally, when it comes to Dowlais, there's the question of how well positioned it is for the transition if and when it does arrive. I was looking this morning just at some analyst comments. I think Citigroup last year initiated coverage with a sell, which is not as common as you may think with a big company, saying actually they think it's going to be quite badly positioned for the transition because they think a lot of its products will be quite easily commoditized and aren't going to be crucial to EVs in future. Whereas a lot of other analysts, RBC among them, say, well, actually, Dowlais is very well positioned to be at the forefront of this transition with the likes of side shafts, things like that. And they acknowledge, you know, that things like side shafts could eventually be replaced and aren't going to be in some EV vehicles in future, but that's a decade down the line. So really, it's, you know, quite far away to be worrying about now. So there's this whole question of how Dowlais slot into that as well. I'm sure the company would say they are very well positioned for the transition.
Well, there's just that general point as well, is that obviously EVs require less parts, you know, significantly less parts than standard automobiles. So, I mean, I guess the bosses there are factoring that into the equation. I mean, it's an impossible situation for management as well, because they don't know they can only guess at the pace of the transition too, and they've got to make capital allocations based on that. And so it's a bit of a nightmare, really.
Given all this, I think a lot of people have put the company in the too hard pile.
Yeah.
That said, the shares are down 25, now 30% since listing, and the valuation is pretty cheap in comparison to some peers. Do you have a thought? Are you in the too hard category, it sounds like, maybe? Or do you think there's real value there?
Yeah, certainly that is, you know, too many moving parts. I think I said both figuratively and literally. So it's, you know, the valuation, the metrics themselves don't make a great, aren't particularly significant when we don't know where the industry as a whole is headed, you know.
Yeah. I think that's a fair summary. Well, let's flip things around now, because we're going to talk about Vodafone. More accurately, I suppose I'm going to talk about it a little bit, because I wrote a feature on it this week. Arthur's going to join in as well, but I'm going to ask you maybe to ask me some questions about Vodafone, Mark, if you'd be so kind.
Yeah, sure. Well, I went through the article, and it's an outstanding piece of work, of course. But a couple of things struck me, and one thing I've often wondered about. We were looking at these successive spectrum auctions that have taken place in the industry. Why is that? Why have they weighed upon the financial performance of Vodafone and maybe some of the other peers in the industry?
I think it's one of these things, isn't it? It's a bit like analogous in a way maybe to BT's investment in fibre to the household broadband, the faster broadband, in that these are investments companies are making for the future, but there hasn't been much of an improvement to the top line in the short term. I think I might be extrapolating from my own opinion here, but I think when you consider 5G, it's not really been the huge step that we were told in terms of changes from 4G. If you think about your phone, whether it's on 4G, 5G, doesn't really affect your day-to-day life that much. There are some potential applications for 5G in relation to the Internet of Things, which Vodafone is betting on in quite a big way, which mean it might be more beneficial, more lucrative for them in future. But right now, it's a bit of a jam tomorrow type situation. I think these investments, these spectrum auctions, we've seen a lot of countries around Europe, the US, still to come in some regions, like in some of the African countries in which Vodafone operates in. You need to bid for these auctions, and it positions you in theory well for the future, but it's quite difficult to make sufficient revenue to compensate for that in the short term. That's my view on it.
And it ties into this general theme through the article as well, is that they're always chasing to catch up with the cost of capital, isn't it? This is where shareholder returns have fallen down. It's that large front-loaded cost in many cases, and just the scramble to sort of try and make a commercial case on the back of it.
Yeah, I mean, this really, I was writing about them before, but really precipitated the publication of this, of course, was last week the decision by Vodafone to halve its dividend, no less, on the back of the announced sale of its Italian business. I mean, it has been divesting assets for a while now. The Spanish business, a sale was agreed at the end of last year. That's going to go through at some point this year. There's the UK merger with Three UK, about which the CMA is due to report its initial findings of its probe in the next couple of days. But the business is trying to recast itself because of the struggle it's had to make money and to sustain its dividend. It was a 10% dividend yield. And yeah, that's a problem across the industry, really, making those returns on investments, making the sums add up. Italy, the cost of capital there, I'm not sure it was making too much more than the cost of capital. In the UK, part of the rationale they're presenting quite forcefully, you'd imagine, to the competition regulator, is that neither Vodafone UK nor Three UK can make enough money to invest what they say is required in 5G again in future. So they're saying a merger is needed. This is a kind of a conversation we've had a lot over the years, the merger that is, in terms of it's a 4-3 situation in the UK market. It'll be a situation where we're left with three main players. Competition authorities across Europe have been quite sceptical about moving down to three players, partly because they think, well, you know, the competition is not necessarily all it's cracked up to be already. If we go down one leg further, it's going to be even harder for consumers. Obviously, we've seen big price rises come through in various aspects of mobile and particularly broadband in recent years as well. That said, the need for investment is relatively pressing, whether it be on the mobile side, the broadband side. So, you know, you've got to balance these two things, and we'll see what the CMA comes out with. I'm going to shift over to Arthur now to get your opinion, Arthur, on Vodafone. What are your thoughts? You cover the company regularly for us. How did you feel about the move last week and its prospects in general?
We've been saying the same story again and again. And the market also doesn't seem to, although we keep saying that they need to make the disposals, when they do happen, the market barely reacts as well, because it feels like they're on a sort of downward spiral. They're almost just the value of its parts that it can sell at this point, it almost appears. But as you say, they need to consolidate in order for the returns on capital to become reasonable. And there's that three merger that regulators are looking at. I guess from that perspective, I just feel like, yeah, as that merger needs to be and probably will be look like approved by the regulator, given that if you're trying to prevent them from having a monopoly and pricing too high, clearly they don't have a monopoly, and because their valuation is so low. Like if they had a monopoly, they'd be one of the worst run monopolies in history. And just the way the market works and how capital intensive it is, it feels like there needs to be a readjustment, and the regulator needs to accept that. I sort of wonder what given they are on this slow descent, I sometimes consider what the world would look like without Vodafone and BT, because although they are becoming more and more costly to run and over time, and their debt is piling up, I also don't know what the alternative to that would look like as well. So it feels like that's maybe a saving grace, is that a reorganization of the market would still include Vodafone and BT in some shape or form, rather than them completely disappearing. I was actually reading an interesting article in the Wall Street Journal the other day about the T-Mobile Sprint merger in 2020. And at the time when they merged, there was a lot of concern that they were creating a monopoly situation and it would hurt the consumers and all the prices would go up. But actually, sort of none of that has come to pass, and prices have come down. Mobile speeds and internet speeds have gone up. And actually, even the company share prices have gone up a bit, but it's not like this monopoly situation that people were concerned about suddenly created huge returns to a handful of businesses. So I don't know whether the UK regulator will be looking at that, but it seems to have created a more healthy market, both from the business's perspective and their shareholders, and from a consumer perspective. So maybe we'll be sort of heading down that route.
Well, yeah, we'll see what the CMA says. It's certainly a good point about the divestments not really prompting much of a reaction. There was I think 5%, maybe 6%, maybe even 7% at the end of the day, uptick in Vodafone share price last Friday, but that was in the context of it having fallen by about that amount in the 4 or 5 days beforehand. So it hasn't really moved on the news of the disposal. You could say that's a positive, given it did halve its dividend, but at the same time, it is promising a lot of buybacks as well as partial compensation. As I alluded to as well, I think the other thing they're trying to do is trying to tell the market they're moving away from huge CapEx spend by focusing on a couple of things. One is selling some of their functions, the common functions they kind of have, the services they offer to their businesses. As they divest more businesses, they think they can commercialize some of this a bit more and sell it to telco partners and the like. And the other is this Internet of Things, this 5G aspect, which, I mean, IoT, again, strikes me as something that has underwhelmed on a consumer side, but I think they see a lot of potential on the business side there, selling these technologies to businesses, whether it's to monitor things like energy use or other aspects. I think they think can be quite lucrative. The growth rates have been quite high there as well. So they're saying really the growth we're seeing in our business arm is going to be enough to meet our investment needs elsewhere in some ways, which is quite a big statement to make, but we'll see if they can do that. The feature, as I say, is online now. It is in the magazine this week. It goes into a lot of detail, well, as much detail as I could muster about various arms of the business, including Germany, which is the main country, the main source of revenue now for the newly shorn business, and which has a lot of its own problems, but we haven't had time to go into today. Before we move on from Vodafone, I just wanted to turn to you, Julian, because I know you have covered telecoms in the past. What are your thoughts on the company?
Well, yes, thank you, Dan. It's completely uninvestable. I think it's the long and the short of it. I don't think there's any value left in for investors looking at telcos unless they're relatively small and specialized. I think that's the big sort of paradox with this is that the monsters just haven't come up with either the economies of scale or the pricing power to be able to make any money over the years. And it does come down to the fact that they are natural. They're monopoly businesses in the sense they need a monopoly to operate. And without that environment, there doesn't seem to be much of a viable future for them. Actually, I did find some old bills from 1995. I had to clear out my mother's house very recently, unfortunately. And they were charging £600 a year just for the privilege of having a phone. So you can imagine that Vodafone and other people can't do that anymore because otherwise people would just switch. So it doesn't have any control over its pricing or what it has to spend on its capital. And it often seems to be surprised by massive amounts of capital spending. So, I mean, in many ways, it's just the worst possible business, I think, is the conclusion on that.
Yeah, well, no mincing of words there. Certainly, when you look at the record over the past, decade, two decades, it doesn't do much to dissuade you from that. But there's always a turnaround plan, as we say. There's always the promise of more jam tomorrow. So we'll be keeping a close eye on the company and seeing
Can I just make another point on that, Dan? Julian's comments there, because I think we spoke earlier on about the example of AT&T in the United States as well. And it may well be that telcos at that end of the market, they do. It's preferable a monopolistic situation because obviously that group was broken up into its constituent parts, but then again, it coalesced over time just because of changes in the industry. And it may well be that the capital demands in telecommunications sort of trigger that. It's worth pondering, at any rate.
It's certainly a more forceful argument than it was when some of these mergers were blocked before. The UK has already previously blocked a 4-into-3 merger, but we will see shortly if they change their mind now, the regulators. Anyway, we've got to move on to our cover story for this week, which is on UK software companies. Arthur, you've written this piece, and it's following on from a similar look you did about 18 months ago, but can we just set the scene for the sector? Because, as I said right at the top, this is a sector now, like most sectors, where fortunes are diverging. It's no longer a one-way bet. And can you say a bit about the context and what you were looking at with the piece?
Yeah. So the scene was there was sort of a general downturn in the software industry when the rate change started to occur. So sort of in 2022 through 2023, most of these companies are high-growth businesses. Interest rates went up. Their valuations came down. But then in the last year or so, there's been a divergence where the companies that have actually continued to grow and produce good cash flow have seen their share prices recover, whereas some of the ones that had their valuations come down but haven't managed to sort of find earnings and cash flow growth have continued to languish. So we've had, some divergence in the industry between the companies that have proven their services and their software to be essential, and then the companies that haven't. There's also probably a little bit more of a nuance to that, which I touch on in the piece, in the sense that it's also very dependent on the company's end market, which I guess is also not unrelated to how essential their software is. But for example, the marketing software companies, some of them have had trouble because marketing is often the sort of first budget line to be cut from businesses. Whereas if you're finance software company, which I can get into, you're much more likely to be cut because finance services within a business are more essential and need to be maintained right to the end rather than marketing services, which can be expensive a bit when times are tough. So yeah, we've had a bit of a divergence in the last couple of years.
Yeah, on that finance side, one company that has done very well and is quite a bit more mature than most of the UK software companies is Sage, of course, proving some of the doubters wrong, although it's taken a long time to do so, but it certainly seems to be flourishing now.
Sage, it's been around for a while and has been through the sort of a few iterations. And because the company was so large, I think there was some skepticism when it wanted to switch to a cloud software product a few years ago. And there was some skepticism when it wanted to go through this process. It has its customers are small and medium-sized businesses. So it has like hundreds of thousands of customers. So it has had a big customer base. It needed to invest in updating its software and making it cloud suitable. And then it needed to transfer all of its customers over. I think there's a lot of skepticism that it would be able to make that pivot. And that's actually quite a common sort of process with the sort of software companies, which is when they want to make some big shift to their product, the investment upfront is pretty significant, and it can take a while for customers to switch over and for the new investment to start generating money. So often, recently, earnings will come down a bit, and then the market will lose a bit of confidence, but often prematurely. With Sage, that happened where its share price came down while it was going through this transition, but now that it's basically transitioned the majority of its customers over to the cloud, it's now generating consistent double-digit revenue growth. And because this investment process is coming to its conclusion, it's now starting to expand its margin. So its operating margin is now above 20%. And its share price has taken off in the last 6 months or so. And like a strong benefit of Sage is that, as I mentioned, because it's a finance software company, its software is pretty essential to these businesses. So basically the only way that it's going to lose customers is if they go bankrupt rather than the customers individually wanting to cut back on their software spend. So Sage has done extremely well. There's an argument in the piece though that actually it's done so well that its valuation is now reaching, it's above 30 times its forward earnings, which one analyst pointed out was the same as Microsoft. So as with all these things, on objective measure, Sage is doing very well, but then you get into the sticky valuation arguments. So, and the other point, which is probably important to make, is they've done very well from this US business they acquired, I think in 2017, called Intacct, which is a software business in the US. And now North America is their largest market, which is generally a good thing because the US economy is growing a bit quicker than its UK counterpart. So the fact that it's now got so much exposure to North America is another added bonus for Sage investors. Mm.
There are many companies mentioned in the piece, but a couple I just want to conclude on, really. The first is Bytes Technology, which I did also discuss on a separate podcast, one of our IC interviews, the other week with Abby Glennie of Aberdeen. But what I didn't discuss when we spoke about Bytes was the CEO ejection, which was announced a few weeks ago. And since that recording, there's been more detail this week on the investigation there. We first talk about what Bytes does, but also maybe we can talk about the share price reaction to that CEO investigation.
Yeah, so Bytes is alongside its peers, Softcat and Computer Center, they're all IT services businesses. So if you're a company and you want to update or your IT services, maybe you're switching from, which is a common thing to do at the moment, you're switching from on-premise server to a cloud server, you'll bring in one of these businesses, and Bytes is one of them, and they will give you advice what sort of cloud provider you should use, and then they are resellers of software as well. So the big software companies like Microsoft don't sell the software directly to you. Bytes will sell it to you on their behalf and set it up for you and give you advice. One of its strengths is it does have, I can't remember the exact phrases, it's like special reseller status with Microsoft Azure, which is Microsoft's cloud product. And that's put it in a good position recently, in particular because of the AI hype. So if any company decides they and wants access to Microsoft Azure, which is its cloud product, and all of the corresponding AI software that comes with that, including Microsoft Copilot 365, which is its new 365 Office product, but with AI capabilities, then Bytes is sort of a go-to vendor for that. So Bytes is, it's been growing quickly over the last few years. I think its gross invoice income was up over 30%. And then now it's sort of been saying that it's going to get this. So with a lot of these IT services businesses, they're kind of going through a bit of a soft spot between COVID and then they're promising that the AI boom will then generate new tailwinds. So during COVID, a lot of the businesses needed to invest heavily in their digital capabilities because of the sudden lockdowns. And now some things are softening off a bit, in both at Computer Center, Bytes and Softcat, from rapid growth during COVID. But then all are saying that they'll then get another kick when the AI boom comes around and companies need to re-upgrade all of their digital capabilities again to make the most of AI, which in part you can say, oh, they're just saying that. Obviously, they're going to say that they're going to get a bunch of extra growth in the future, and this is just a temporary soft patch. But also, that's kind of just how technology works, which is that something will happen and everyone needs to update their computers, and then something else will happen and they need to update their computers again. So although these are two very specific situations, it does speak to a more generality, which is that computer products keep improving and companies keep needing to invest in them. So I like those companies. Their valuations are a little, Computer Center's cheaper than Softcat and Bytes, but it's also growing slower. Softcat and Bytes valuations are pretty high given their low margins, like services businesses. But I like them because, unlike specific software companies, they benefit from a general improvement in our digital capabilities. And if there's like a new great bit of software comes out, that's only going to be good for the IT services businesses. So they're not as constrained and like specific as the individual software companies I mentioned in the piece. Do you want to get into Bytes' specific CEO situation now? I've covered the...
I do. Yeah. I do, because so this is, I suppose I'll just set the scene, because the CEO resigned in February, and there was discussion of unauthorized share trades. And then this week, Bytes said that, or they say, it transpired that the CEO had engaged in unauthorized and undisclosed trading of the company's shares on 66 days, totaling 119 transactions, which is obviously, if true, quite a lot and a very serious allegation. And maybe that explains why the share price has been moved so much, because there's a lot of uncertainty now about this investigation and what's going to happen next, because this really has provided two separate large knocks to the share price.
Yeah, when the share price came down initially, I just sort of viewed it as a buying opportunity, because I don't really buy into the fact that there are that many CEOs with like huge star power. And when its share price came off 15% or so in the initial announcement, I just thought that made a company that was kind of expensive 15% cheaper, and things would sort of carry on. They would find a new person and things would carry on. And it was a very specific issue with him selling his shares in the company. Whereas, like, for example, we had another scandal in the software sector recently with WAN Disco, but it turned out that one of the salesmen was just completely misrepresenting their revenue. And that's like a completely different situation where you can't, it just changes your whole perspective of the business. But with this, it was sort of a specific issue with him. But then the other announcement came out, and the second announcement, really with a few more details, really just read as the board was sort of not angry, but just very sort of surprised and sad and disappointed with him. And the share price came down again. I guess it just throws all of their governance into question, which is why they're getting this huge sort of this big share price reaction. I don't know how much of it is tied into people thinking that he was a real superstar CEO, though. I'm not sure. Do you have any views, Dan?
There's always uncertainty. Uncertainty always causes problems, doesn't it? Especially when you're relatively richly valued. I think, the fact they're investigating further, you wonder what's going to come out of that. Because I should say, in relation to what I was saying before about the charges, there doesn't seem to be any denial of the fact that these trades happened. Nonetheless, you know, the company has to look into it, and I think, as we were discussing yesterday in the office, that will distract the board's attention from the day-to-day business for a while as well, the fact that this investigation is going on. So it's things like that. I mean, the reaction has been quite extreme, but then the company was not priced for perfection, but priced relatively richly, I suppose. So any anything that jeopardizes the investment case in that regard might lead to this kind of fall. It certainly has put question marks over the business in the short term. There is also the aspect, isn't there, of they put out a trading update the other day as well, and looking at Copilot sales and how they're able to capitalize on that, maybe a little bit softer than they previously said. That may be having an impact too, but hopefully in time the business will be able to get back to what it does best, and investors can focus on that as well. Unfortunately, we're running out of time, so we won't be able to discuss the final company I wanted to, which is Keywords, but do look out for that in the piece. There's a lot of information on there in relation to, well, Keywords and AI, but the software sector in general and all the changes that it's seen over the past couple of years. That does bring us to the end.
And Gamma Communications as well. I like that.
And Gamma Communications as well, I think Arthur wants me to mention, which is, they are reporting results in the next few days, so we'll see how this pans out as well. That brings us to the end of today's show, though. So thank you very much to everyone. Thank you to Arthur, to Julian, and to Mark, and to our producer, Maddie Apthorpe. And thank you to you for listening. We'll be back next week with another Companies and Markets show.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.